Hi, everybody. This is Lori Handlers. I'm your host of Tantra Cafe, a program for spiritual enlightenment. And you are listening to bbsradio.com. The show Tantra Cafe, always I start with a greeting, Om Shanti Shanti Shanti, and that means to you in peace, really in peace, that we meet in peace. And I love to demystify Tantra for you in the beginning of the show, and then we go in right into the daily or the weekly specials or our main course. So tonight, I want to tell you a little bit about the show before I introduce my guest. Tonight's show is going to be about India, longing for India, loving India, feeling India as the motherland. And you may be asking, you know, okay, so what does this have to do with Tantra? Although you probably know intuitively that, you know, Tantra comes from India. I actually believe that when people ask me, you know, where does Tantra come from, I usually tell them it's my belief that it started in ancient Egypt. It just feels organically true that it may have started in Egypt because there's so many ancient Egyptian practices that are so similar to the things I've studied in Tantra, which resemble more a kind of Indian flair. I do think it started in Egypt and that it moved over with the spice traders or whoever. It moved over to India, southern India, and that's really where it flourished. And my guest tonight knows, she's like an expert in these kind of things. She knows so much about this, and she's traveled so extensively in India. I have too, but I don't know. I always feel like I'm on a wild goose chase looking for tantrikas, looking for real tantric masters when I'm there, and I think she's had better luck than me in finding them. So in moments, I'll introduce her, and we'll find out exactly about whether my assumptions are true. But anyway, Tantra did flourish in India, especially in the southern part of India, where there was great goddess worship, and there were incredibly esoteric practices, which had to do with lovemaking, but also with many other things, with things, yantra and mantra, which yantra is an aid that you look at to help you meditate, but it really also symbolizes a whole other plane, a whole other plane of reality. And then mantra, those are sounds that people make, and those kinds of things, again, the sounds that vibrate in the body and help one to come into realization or into actualization, if we put it in a Western term. And those things really did happen in India. And again, there's commonalities in Egyptian practices. There's commonalities in Kabbalah. There's common practices if you look throughout the whole Southeast. But many of those cultures got Tantra later on. And I still, it's my belief that people like Marco Polo came down into India looking for spices and then went back to Silk Road and brought these practices to the Tibetans, the Cambodians, the Japanese, the Chinese, all these different, the Tibetans. So we'll find out. These are the things that I've been thinking, I've been feeling for a long time. And going to India is like going to another planet for me. And I love it there, and I find traces everywhere of the things that I use in my courses for Tantra, and I've studied, and more of it becomes concrete for me when I go and come back from India, because I feel like I've the smells and every essence of India has gotten into my pores, and it makes my Tantra feel more legitimate. All the practices that I've talked to you about in many weeks gone by, and many of you who are students of mine, everything feels more legit when I come back from India. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce my guest tonight. Her name is Paula Gloria, and she is a visionary. She is a brilliant, eclectic, well-studied, well-rounded woman who challenges everything. You know those buttons? I don't know, I used to wear a button that said challenge authority, and Paula is the epitome of somebody to me who challenges authority, who challenges the current beliefs. She is the host of a daily television show She posts everything on YouTube, and the show is called Farther Down the Rabbit Hole. And she'll tell you about that this evening, too, and you'll also find out about how you can contact her. So, Paula, are you there? I want to welcome you. Hi, are you there?
Oh, yes, I am. It's always a joy to be with you, Laurie. I really, really like working with you.
Thank you. The feeling is mutual. This is your second time on my show. Last time we discussed
I remember
New York.
I bicycled down. You were in downtown, and it was just such a nice first encounter, you know, how we were able to work together and blend our different backgrounds. I'm so flattered by what you said, and there's just so many directions to go, and I'm wondering how we can best use the time.
Well, I have a few questions to ask you that I think would get us kicked off, and then, knowing you and knowing me, we'll go around a little bit.
We'll go
in a couple of different directions, but I think, you know, primarily, one thing I'd like people to know, first of all, I want everyone to know that I would never have had the times I have had in India had I not met you, because you introduced me to my guide in India, Amit.
Right.
So what I want to know, first of all, is when did you first go to India? You know, what was the first year you stepped into India?
The first time I went to India is when I was in the Transcendental Meditation Movement with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and I was sort of working as a little clerk, I guess you'd say, at the Pacific Palisades Center, where it just processing forms, and it didn't look like little Cinderella was going to go anywhere, but all of a sudden, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi wanted everybody to go to a really, really special course, and there were scholarships available. I think it's the first time I got a scholarship, and I got all the way to India. And I'll never forget, as soon as the airplane touched the ground, I felt like I came home. So I must have been 28 years old then. That was in 1980. 27, 28, something like that.
And how long did you stay that time, particularly?
I stayed 3 months. It was a very intense course, mostly because too many people were packed into too small a place. But that's when Deepak Chopra was launched. I remember watching that happen.
Yes, Deepak Chopra. It's a little known fact these days, but that is the truth. Deepak Chopra started his whole, everything that he is today is based on his original studies, his original dedication to Maharishi Mahesh.
Right. I remember he left, obviously being a professional guy, he didn't have 3 months to spend. And as Maharishi was telling him goodbye in front of the whole group, he said, go home and find natural law in the work that you do. Find natural law. So he sent everyone off saying that Ayurveda, which we think of as the natural indigenous Indian medicine, is something that's only for India. And a lot of people say, oh, Paula, why did you go up to India? Why don't you find what you like here? And you don't need Ayurveda, and all the herbs, you know, are right for Indians, but not here. But it's not about the herbs, it's about the principles.
Yes.
And that's what he told him. Another thing you know, Deepak Chopra says that in India that Hitler turned the swastika the wrong way or the other way. And actually it's not true. The way Hitler had the swastika and all of India is the same direction. The only time I saw it a different direction was on Madame Blavatsky's statue down in Chennai in the south, what used to be known as Madras.
Well, you know, I think we touched on this the last time you were on the show. I learned in India that the swastika means the four rivers that come in to make the Ganges, and that it's a holy symbol. And then you talked about it being the cross on fire.
Yeah, the fiery cross is what the Theosophical Society said. A lot of people don't realize that the Theosophical Society was actually founded in 1882 or 92 by Colonel Olcott, who'd been a whistleblower during the Civil War, and Madame Blavatsky. And then they went over to India, and then there was some scandal because they were performing some miracles for some prominent people, like the editor of, I think, The Pioneer, which was India's outstanding newspaper. And these people were upset that word leaked out that they were participating in seances or whatever. So Blavatsky and Olcott went down to Sri Lanka, And in Sri Lanka, they actually kick-started Buddhism, which was about on its way out, you know, almost getting killed by the Christian missionaries, which continues to kind of plague India even today. On one hand, the Christians are known for charity, so they adore Mother Teresa, but when you go a little deeper, they're very annoyed by a lot of money laundering and things like that that goes on.
It's amazing what the things that you know. You know, like factoids to the nth degree, like amazing stuff.
I hung out for 4 years. I mean, I remember one of the investigative journalists was hoping I could get the Dalai Lama to sit down with the Dorje Sujun Tibetan group to see if they could work out their differences. And I didn't realize I was walking into one of the most controversial topics. So it's, I don't know if I was being baited on or goaded on, or in my naivete or innocence, I stumbled on more than I could handle. But boy, I sure backed off that one quick.
Well,
I mean, there's things that Westerners don't see.
Yeah.
It takes a while.
Well, that goes without saying. That's the thing, the subtleties. Well, let's just go back for a little, because we're in 20 subjects. I knew we would be. When you, how long, you've had times where you stayed in India for a year or so, or 2 years at a time, is that true?
The first time I went in 1980, I didn't have any money, so I was just kind of a ward of the TM movement. But
so you just stayed and stayed and stayed?
No, I just stayed 3 months, and then I had, they had the ticket home, and you had to go home.
Oh.
But I always wanted to go back, so I went back. I got so disgusted being in the TM cult just because, you know, I needed to do my own thing, you know, not live somebody else's dream.
Yeah.
And I started a little business. My mom gave me $5,000, and I started a retail wicker furniture store, and the supplies were wicker that was made by meditation facilities overseas that were set up to give the workers a more humane working condition, because if you taught the average worker how to meditate, they'd fall asleep because they're so, you know, homeless and needing a job and things. So I had that furniture on consignment, and that's how I started my independence. And then after maybe 7 years, I built up money a little bit. I think I had $30,000, put it all in the cellular telephone lotteries, got a license in Kentucky. Based on the collateral of the license, borrowed $8 million from AT&T. Eventually, that license was sold because I fell in love and my partner sold it behind my back. So I took my $5 million, created a charity, headed off to Cyprus, tried to create. By that time, I was tired of spiritual practice, and I wanted something, you know, more hands-on concrete, so I thought I'd look into building a little eco-village with renewable energies and things like that. And then at that time in Cyprus, Vincenzo and I used to go back and forth to India. Cyprus was equidistant between London and New Delhi.
And, oh, yeah, it is, of course.
Yeah, and I was 4 years in India, in Cyprus. And so we would go back and forth.
To India, I see.
To India,
I see.
Yeah.
Well, how did, it's hard to say. Like, for me, you know a lot about Tantra. You know the mantras, you know the yantras, you've had.
Well, that was because of Swami. Sri Sai Kaleshwara Swami was a young manifesting saint, and I thought I was finished with Indian gurus. And one a contact I had in the TM days, but he was also kind of a guy that raises money in Hollywood kind of thing. He was telling me I had to see this miracle master, and I thought, what do I want to see a miracle master for? And when I actually finally met him, I had actually come out of a wine ceremony at the Rampa School where I had to jump the fence because this miracle master was only going to be in town for one day, and I didn't, and you know, up in Yale, Washington. So I left the Rampa School just to see him that night and snuck back in. And the wine ceremony had been going on for 12 hours. So I didn't even miss anything. It was like a miracle that the doors were unlocked because, you know, at the Ramtha school, they don't want drunks wandering around and getting the school shut down because it's a very sacred process also to use wine to drop the veils of social conditioning. So that was probably the first step of a tantric practice. It was actually at the Ramtha school because up until then, TM was all about purification. When I was in Cyprus with Vincenzo, I was eating grapes for 6 weeks. We always were attracted to flower essences, healing. I went over to Tel Aviv to study Alexander and Feldenkrais because I've had major back surgery. You know, so Tantra, but it was really the young master, Sri Sai Kaleshwara Swami, that really got me to sit on my butt for a long, long time and do these long mantras. And it's just heartbreaking. It's just so tough. And you just think, I don't know how to explain it. It's like it was so different from TM, but I realized what he was giving me was independence. And he had to show what you kind of have to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. And the practice I was doing was something that I attracted to me because my soul just so desperately and deeply wanted powerful solutions for big problems. And the problem that attracted this master in my life was pedophilia. I really wanted to understand how could people do such things to children. So, and he told me I had to learn the sexual energies, which he actually never taught me. It was something I had to kind of figure out by myself because I didn't have... You have to get to a place of unconditional love. And if a master sees that you're not in unconditional love, he's not going to lay it on you.
Yeah. Well, because you wouldn't be able to handle it. It'll be used all for the ego. I mean, the whole problem is that people take the sexual energies before they're ready, and they use this whole mixture as a potent mixture. They use the whole mixture to do conquest and be predators and whatever. And so, of course, they want you to be in a pretty neutral and compassionate space before they're going to give you such responsibility.
Well, a huge teacher to me was Marshall Rosenberg in his nonviolent communication because he says that punishment never works and also reward never works. And I was upset at this big guru in the South who was a known pedophile, and I was just indignant and horrified, and it made me want to
turn... In the South of India?
Yeah. It made me want to turn my back on all spiritual practice. So the young master was saying... You know, that he said I needed God power and I needed angel power. He talked about power objects. I mean, I just thought, this is just so bizarre, this is so weird. But I couldn't even begin to understand what he was saying. And I thought, how can I make a judgment on what he's saying and say, this is not for me if I don't even know what he's saying? So I had to stick around long enough to figure out what he was saying to decide whether or not this was something that I wanted to do. And most of the time I was there, I thought, this is not what I wanted to do. I certainly didn't want to live in an ashram. But he gave me a lot of freedom. I had permission to come and go whenever I wanted. So I could take the train around, whereas most people were not allowed to take the train. And I think he felt a lot of responsibility because you get the Westerners stumbling around. And there are dangerous things going on in India politically. And Americans, their presence there can be very misunderstood.
Well, you aren't your typical tourist, Paula. I mean, you're not your typical anything. You're amazing, and you're a person unto yourself. You're very unique. There's nobody else that I know that even closely resembles you. So I imagine that, you know, these people took a look at you and had a sense. She's different. We can give her these freedoms because that's probably what your soul is calling in anyway.
I think he probably also knew if he told me I couldn't ride the trains after I'd been riding the trains for so many years that I would just blow off the whole ashram, and he had something up his sleeve. I don't know if he ever accomplished what he hoped to accomplish with me. All I know is that having come home, and now about 3 years has gone by, and I've exerted myself on my TV and internet stuff. And I don't think of him obsessively like I used to think of Maharishi, but every once in a while it becomes so apparent to me that there's no way I could be accomplishing what I am without this type of divine self-sufficient knowledge. And for that, my heart really expands and I feel deep gratitude.
Mm.
Now, whether he's the teacher for everyone, I don't know.
That's a powerful, powerful statement. Let me just stop for a second here because
sure.
I want to let people know if they're listening. I want to let them know how they can call in, and then we're going to take a short break. So if you just tuned in, you're listening to Tantra Cafe. I'm Laurie Handlers. I'm your host, and I am here with Paula Gloria, who is the TV host of Farther Down the Rabbit Hole. We're discussing India, and we, you know, of course, we've already touched, in the way of just finding out Paul's experience, we've touched on, you know, at least 10 or 12 different things. If you want to call in, the numbers in the USA and Canada are 888-228-4494. And if you are anywhere else in the world listening in, which you might be, you can reach us on 877-489-6350. I hope you do call in. You can also send me a fast chat on live on the BBS radio website. We will be back in a moment. Right now we're going to stop to honor our sponsors, and we'll be back momentarily with Tantra Cafe.
Are you feeling like you just don't get it? All this talk about sex and love, love and sex. Feeling like all people ever think about and talk about is sex. Maybe you are longing for a more spiritual sexual connection. Hey, maybe you are just totally confused about all of it. Laurie Handler's new book, Sex and Happiness, The Tantric Laws of Intimacy, puts the innocence and love back into sex. And it gives Tantra the respect it truly deserves. In this book, you will discover a wonderful meditation on self-love. You will also find fun new ways to develop an intimacy with yourself, whether or not you have a partner. And now, for only $19.99, you can get your copy of Sex and Happiness, The Tantric Laws of Intimacy. Right now, go to www.sexandhappiness.com and order your copy. Give yourself the gift.
That's sexandhappiness.com.
Are you someone who's looking for more pleasure in your life and you've never heard of Eve's Garden? Eve's Garden is a comfortable and elegant environment for women to explore the tools of pleasure and other educational materials. These materials enhance mind, body, and spirit. Eve's Garden encourages women to take responsibility for their own sexuality and clearly understand that bodily pleasure and spiritual joy are one and the same. While in New York City, you can visit the store at 119 West 57th Street, Suite 1201. And now, for a limited time, you can get a 15% discount on everything in stock if you go through evesgarden.com/Tantra Cafe. Go there now. Well, welcome back, everybody. Thanks for staying tuned. You're listening to Tantra Cafe on BBSRadio.com. I'm Laurie Handlers, your host. I'm here with Paula Gloria, and in a moment we're about to be joined by Molly Cheshire, Paula's friend who was with her for a lot of the time in India. And Molly, are you there? Let's just say hello to you.
Hi.
Hi, Molly. Great to have you with us. And
hi, Laurie.
Just before we get started, I've been told that we have a caller, John from Puerto Rico. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi. Calling into Tantra Cafe.
Hi, John. How are you?
Okay.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, I know. I wanted to ask how Paula felt when she left India. She came back to New York.
How did she feel? So the question is, Paula, how did you feel when you came back to New York after leaving India?
Well, as you know, I was there for 4 years. In the 4 years I was in India, I only came back for 1 month. And that 1 month was about a year after 9/11. And I was in India during 9/11. So things had changed a lot. I mean, first of all, I left for India rich, and when I came back, I was poor. My finances had totally changed. However, I came back very confident about what I wanted to do.
Okay, good, good. John, do you have some assumption about that, or have you been to India?
Oh, I was wondering how. Yeah, I wanted to ask her how 9/11 affected her, if it affected her in any way. I'm sure the listeners out there would be very interested.
Okay, obviously everybody knows where they were when they heard about 9/11. I was out in a lawn. I remember the lady that told me because she was listening to the radio. We didn't have that very easy access to the outside world. I think I was scheduled to go into Bangalore the next day, and when I went into Bangalore, I remember I had a remarkable connection with the beggars. Because the beggars in the railway station, Laura, you would relate to this because you've been to India, they were so compassionate towards me. They were so kind, and I felt like if I had no home, if America was completely blown up, that
Was this because they were reflecting what was happening at the time with 9/11, and they were empathizing with you?
Yes, yes. They were really, really empathizing. They felt so sorry for me being an American that it was so profoundly touching, and it made me feel like I had a beggar family, that there'd be a place for me to go, that they'd let me sleep on their little
piece. Were you worried being an American in India at that moment?
Was I what?
Were you afraid of yourself, your safety in India at any time?
I never was. I really never was. I mean, I remember once, you know, since this is Tantra Cafe, I was in a train and there was some guy masturbating, looking at me, and I remember being indignant about it. And then I remember there was some kind of guy that everybody was afraid of. Sometimes if you go around Bihar, it's really tough up there.
Yeah, very, very.
Yeah, and even the police are afraid. So these thugs get on the trains and they take the tickets and they push other people aside. Well, somehow one of these guys woke me up from the middle of my deep sleep. And I was just like the embodiment of Kali, you know. I just flashed out at him. I said, "Where's your ticket?" These other people were all wide-eyed, and it's like he didn't know. I guess because of my white skin, he just didn't have a slot for what was happening.
Was it like the American in you kind of like blew up and said, "Hey, I'm an American. Get your goddamn hands off."
Well, you know what it was. You know what it was, John. It was me being indignant that he was pushing around people who had tickets. It wasn't just about me. It was also about other people.
Yeah,
and
they pick on them. They pick on the untouchables, as they call them. Even like the poor folks.
Yeah, but I always get a lot of support because I really love common people. Like I remember some Indians would say, "Hey, you know, there's so many Indians here. How can you stand it?" And I said, "Look, I love India. If I didn't like people, why would I be here?"
That's exactly.
You know, that's
right.
Interesting because I was very I'm very interested in the fact that women like you and the host here, very lovely people, how you went to India looking for peace and tranquility and the spiritual kind of education, whereas I've always wondered if men aren't in some way not drawn to that, but drawn more to like a warlike country or something. Because when I was very young, I was more interested in going places that were more dangerous. So to speak,
what, you like mean like
Middle
Israel
East.
Or
Israel,
the Middle East?
Egypt, you know, being in the Gaza Strip, the Sinai Desert, I mean, just being in like these really hot spots and finding a kind of serenity within this chaos. And I find that, you know, there's a kind of opposites here, in a sense.
Well, look at, India has certainly had its share of violence, for sure, for sure.
Yeah,
but when they interact with you, the Indians want to be hospitable and pleasing to you, and so they're not going to say this. Like, there's a very different opinion about Mahatma Gandhi. If you can get really deeper into the Indian psyche, you know, he hemorrhaged a lot of gold out of India when the British.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, it took millions of dollars to keep him in poverty, for crying out loud. I mean,
Well, I want to say something else about Mahatma Gandhi, as long as we're on the Gandhi subject. If you go to Khajuraho, where there's the greatest grouping of Tantra temples, all the famous pictures of couples together, coupling in every which way, etc., that are the most beautiful sculptures you can imagine on the temples of the Khajuraho walls. It's said that Gandhi was embarrassed by all those sculptures and wanted to have the whole thing buried in sand. He wanted to have mountains built that would cover each temple so that tourists and other people would never stumble upon it, because it was unexplainable why all these people were having explicit sex on these temple walls. And I don't know.
Was there a lot of pedophilia? Was there pedophilia going on?
It's not pedophilia, John. In what Laurie's describing, Khajuraho is probably the highest expression of Indian sculpture. Certainly, what.
Oh, I see what you mean. It's like a sex. Yeah, I see what you mean. It's like a sex museum or something. Like something.
Oh,
big.
No. It's
no, no. It's a temple that and out on the outside there are depictions of the human condition of sexuality.
Yeah, like
and joy.
Pompeii is that way.
Pompeii.
Yes. It's a very sexualized. Yes, a very free sexualized representation of the society that where this was okay. That's what I meant. Like, you go to Amsterdam, the free sex sort of. Yes.
But then when you go inside the temples, there's nothing. It's blank. And what Osho, a very famous Tantra master, has said is that you start with the addictions and the attachments. So in life, our egos are attached to. To the flesh, to it has to be, you know, we have to do all this, and then as we get higher and higher and actually more compassionate and more accepting of the human condition, we go inside and there's nothing, there isn't attachment to that. So when you go inside the temple, there isn't anything, it's like a big cave. It's a very interesting. Anyway, let me ask you a question. Do you have any other questions for us? Because
I just wanted to say it's a great show. I'm going to sign off. And I just want to say thank you for letting me on.
And thank you, John, for calling.
You're welcome, Paul.
I want to say also that Sabrina said she would come on the show if you come on.
Yeah, I'll do it.
Oh, that's Laurie. There's you know that I do a lot of work in 9/11 Truth, which has different factions that oftentimes are contentious to each other.
Yeah.
And John kind of got
involved. Yeah, I'm sort of one of the I'm one of the kooks from Paula's. Pantheon of 9/11 magic,
Well, I'm so glad to meet you, John, and I hope that you become part of the Tantra, you know, Tantra movement as well. So,
I've got a great teacher with Paula.
That's so great. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you. It was nice meeting you.
Good.
Take care. Bye.
Okay, well, we have a lot of things on the table now. We have how safe did you feel in India, you know, how safe did I feel in India, Molly, how safe did you feel in India, you know, like that. We also have, you know, what were we doing there? What were we looking for? I mean, I think he raises a really good question, whether, you know, even that you were there for 9/11, but what, you know, I actually can articulate what I have found there, which I have rarely found anywhere else on the planet. And that is a certain honoring of me, a certain way people, whether they're the beggars who you just mentioned, or whether they're the people in higher society that I meet, or somebody somewhere in the middle, from whatever caste, from whatever class, there's a certain way that people greet me there. There's a certain way that people honor me there, especially ones who have seen me there over and over again. It's like they're so happy that I'm there. They're so thrilled to try and please me and serve me. I rarely experience that anywhere else.
Do you know why that is, Laurie?
No.
It's because there's a tradition of pilgrimage, and the idea is the poorest Indian will go to different parts of India to visit different parts of the Divine Mother's body. You know, some is her foot and some is her breast. And so by opening their hearts up to you and to honoring you having come all the way across the ocean to be there, they participate in your good karma.
I see. I like that. I like that notion then. I mean, that works for me.
Yeah.
I also think that the Indians just have big hearts.
Yeah. They do have big hearts. Now, I mean, there's a lot of things they have that I don't agree with. You know, like that. I think that, you know, the dichotomy between women and men there and certain things in the caste system and certain other, you know, parts of the religion. I mean, there's a lot of things we could debate, but you're right. I think they have really big hearts. I think they really, and I just think, I just love the way I'm treated there. I really feel like the goddess when I'm there. I feel just, it feels amazing to me. I feel like I'm home in a way that I don't feel home when I'm here, even though this is my home, even though New York is my home. Or wherever I go in this country, it's pretty much my home. I mean, Washington was my home for 25 years. The people I know and where I go, I feel like it's home, but there's something about the Indians that just makes me feel so honored, so revered, so respected, so wanted, whatever. You know, I like it. I like it a lot.
Lori, have you spent a lot of time in the South?
I spent, the last time I was there, I was in Trivandrum, and I was at the Shivananda Ashram for a week, and I was on the beach for a week, and then I found this tantric priest, and I was trying to make an appointment with him. I met these priests who, they were the real deal. They did all these tantric fire ceremonies, all these things I really wanted to participate in. But the man didn't speak English, and my interpreter, who was trying to get him on the phone, they didn't speak Hindi either. They spoke like Malayalam or whatever.
Yeah, Malayalam is a very difficult language.
Yeah, Malayalam, yeah. So and then it was around, it was Christmas time, so this man was doing puja after puja after puja in Trivandrum, all around Trivandrum. And I couldn't, you know, he didn't really care about me. He wasn't like bending over backwards that some American woman wanted to study fire ceremony with him. You know, he was like, you know, so what? So I never connected with him. And I got, you know, kind of frustrated and I left.
I know it can be frustrating. I remember when Vincenzo and I, we hired a priest to take us in Varanasi because we wanted to go out at sunrise and do a ceremony on the river. On the Ganges,
yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
So to honor our friends, family, you know, gurus and priests, we put them in a nice hotel. Well, they were so impressed with the hotel, they didn't want to get up in the morning and leave the hotel. It's so funny, we have to keep pounding on the door, come on, the sun is rising, get out of bed. In a hotel like that before, you know, so... That's when you start learning that you have to kind of have to go with the flow and what is such a small amount of you can really, really be very disturbing to the flow.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, you know, I also had an experience. I wanted to see if it's time for us to take a break. Oh, in a few minutes, we have to take a break. Let me share this. Both of you know Amit, and I had an experience where I was meeting him. I was taking a bus from Pune to Goa, and I was on my way to Goa, and there's a small town in Goa where the buses stop, Mimsa, and the bus, who would think, I mean, everything in the third world seems to be late all the time. The trains in India run late lots of the time, and, you know, pickups never happen, and things, you know, all kinds of things. But anyway, my bus, which was an all-night bus, and it was a terrible bus, and I was in like a little bunk in that bus, and I put all my suitcases in so nobody could come in, like the thing you discussed earlier. I didn't want any man, like, coming in there and trying to...
Oh, right, you didn't want to, yeah.
Yeah, and so I was in this thing, I was in the back of the bus, I was banging up and down, there were no shock absorbers, I was getting whiplash while lying down, and the bus driver never took a break all night, so, of course, I had to pee. Everybody probably had to pee. I don't know. But we were supposed to get into the town at 6:30. And this man spit me out. This bus driver spit me out of that bus by myself at 5 a.m. It was pitch black in this town. I had my suitcases, and I was scared to death. There was no moon. It was like a new moon, you know, so there's no light. And I got out of this bus. I'm scared out of my mind. Amit's not supposed to come till 6:30.
And no street lights.
There was nothing. And I'm like, okay. And then all these men come running up and they're like, taxi, madam? Taxi, madam? And I said, no taxi. I just stood there and I was scared because there was only men and me in this dark. And I saw this little light, one little light bulb hanging from like a string. And I remember my first spiritual teacher was Isabel Hickey, the famous astrologer. And Izzy used to say, if you see a light, go to it. So I pulled my suitcases towards the light, and it was a chai shop. And it was 5 o'clock in the morning, and I sat down on this little plastic bench, and I ordered chai, although you know I didn't want to put anything in because I really couldn't hold anything more. But I was, you know, where was I going to find a bathroom? So I just sat down and I waited an hour and a half. And I was really scared, was surrounded by these men all staring at me. And I realized at some point that they weren't staring at me like Americans stare, like Western men stare. They weren't looking at like for tits and ass, you know, they were just like looking at me. I was different. I was a blonde American. I was completely an oddity, and they just stare.
Right.
And when I realized, like, it wasn't that thing, you know, that, like, hey, baby thing. It was just like they were just staring. I relaxed, and I stopped being afraid. Like, I stopped projecting my Western fears onto them, and I just sat there and drank my chai. At 6:35, Amit came running up, and he went, oh, Laurie, I'm so sorry. I'm 5 minutes late, and I went, hold my suitcases. I have to find a toilet. You know, I said, you don't even know, you know, just stay here for a minute. And it was a freeing experience to realize that they weren't looking at me the way I'm used to being looked at, you know, walking by the guys who were in gym class, you know, the jocks from high school or the boys in the fraternities at college or the guys who were doing construction on the streets of Manhattan. Like, it was a different feeling. They were just looking.
I know. I remember Alan and I somehow wound up in a village way in the south, and the people are so black, they're blue. And we stopped to ask
for directions. Was this in Tamil?
Excuse me?
In Tamil?
It's somewhere in Tamil Nadu.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we were asking for directions, and somehow these two guys at the side of the road saw us in the back seat. And Alan kept trying to ask them something. And they looked at Alan as if the dog had just started talking. They were so blown that, you know, Alan was getting frustrated that they weren't responding. But I could see it was like somebody landed from the moon. It was like,
yeah.
It was...
Well,
yeah.
Alan does have that alien look about him.
For those people who don't know who we're talking about now, we're talking about Alan Steinfeld, who was the guest of my very first show on Tantra Cafe. You can go on my Tantra Cafe website and hear a show with Alan where we talk about Tantra and the legitimizing of Tantra in the West. You know, we have to take another break. So I just want to let the audience know how to reach us if anyone else wants to call. I lost that page. Hold on a second. If you want to call us, you can reach us at 888-228-4494 in the U.S. and Canada. And if you're calling in from anywhere else in the world, 877-489-6350. This is Tantra Cafe. I'm Laurie Handlers. I'll be back in a moment with my guests, Paula and Molly, and we'll be talking a little bit more about India, and we'll try to relate it to Tantra. Stay tuned.
It's all Tantra.
Hi, Laurie Handlers. Personally invite you to come with me on a tantric tour of the heart of India, November 19th to December 1st, 2008. You'll see the Taj Mahal and visit the fabulous Fatehpur Sikri, home of the great Mughal king Akbar. You'll experience Jaipur, the pink city, and visit the sacred lake of Pushkar. Then, at dawn from a boat on the Ganges in Varanasi, you'll see exquisite Hindu prayer rituals. You'll tour Sarnath, where the Buddha gave his first speech after attaining enlightenment, and then you'll explore the exotic Kama Sutra temples of Khajuraho. Finally, you'll shop till you drop in the Paraganj Bazaar in New Delhi. Throughout the tour, you'll learn tantric techniques and principles, and I promise you'll feel a tremendous sense of well-being as we delve into these simple yet potent tantric tools. Please note that no previous experience with tantra or yoga is necessary. I invite you to join me in this unique experience touring the incredible country of India. And I must warn you, this is not your typical tour, and you are not a typical tourist.
For more information about this exciting tantric tour of the heart of India, contact Lori at butterflyworkshops.com or write to her at info@butterflyworkshops.com.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Laurie Handlers. You're listening to Tantra Cafe. I'm here with my guests, Paula Gloria and Molly Cheshire. And I just want to let you know the piece of music you just heard is called Namah Shivaya, and it's by Krishna Das. And it's on many albums, various compilations. I have it on an album called Chill Out Bombay, which is a CD. And it's possible. One of the funniest things about India is being on the Ganges in Varanasi, where people are making pilgrimages to pray, and they pray in the river. They actually like take most of their clothes off, not all their clothes off, but they take most of their clothes off, and they bathe in the river in the early morning dawn. Paula just mentioned a sequence about that before, wanting to have a special ceremony and not being able to wake up the priest because they were so happy with the high-class hotel they were staying in. There are people who also do selling things on the river. They have boats full of merchandise, like necklaces and CDs and statues of all the deities and all kinds of things. And almost anything you can buy in the street, you can also buy on the river in a boat. So these people come by with big boom boxes, and they play the song you just heard, Namah Shivaya, because they know that many Westerners have heard it. And they try to do that to get your attention so that you'll go shopping while you're watching this very spiritual religious pilgrimage. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed that song. I use that in my courses. I use it in a men's ceremony, actually, in my ecstasy course. When we just left, Molly kind of fit in the little statement, everything is tantra. So I want to come back on that. I want to say, Molly, can you say a little something more about that?
Well, I guess that Westerners have a tendency to associate sex with tantra exclusively, and that's just an aspect of the manifestation that tantra, to me, really is about, is manifestation here on the earthly plane.
So it would be the manifestation of everything,
yeah,
which is what you mean. Everything.
I would say that anybody who's working with the elements is using some form of tantra, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I would say. So you mean like earth, wind, fire, air, ether, that kind of stuff, and manifesting. Anything manifesting on the feminine plane has to do with tantra. Setting intention
and
manifesting.
The interesting thing about the sexual energy is that when you combine the male and the female, it's one of the most potent creative forces. And I think that that's one of the aspects that's gotten emphasized.
Well, yeah, it has. It has. But people think, you know, a lot of times on my show, I've said it on almost every show, so I kind of stopped saying it already because it's getting boring to me. But I always say pretty much in the beginning of the show, you know, people think they're going to come on this show and they're going to hear kinky, esoteric sex practices. And, you know, occasionally we do throw in a little sex stuff on the show, but it's so much more than that. And I do say it a lot. A couple of weeks ago, I had a guy on the show who's like a regular family guy. You know, he raised his two daughters by himself. He's a financial planner. And, I was making the point that he's a guy just like you, you know, just like anybody who would be listening to the show. Here's somebody who's just like you, a family man, and he practices Tantra, and he shares a lot of what he learns with his daughters. He's not doing sex stuff with them. You know, he's giving them practical knowledge that helps them make it through their life, you know, like calm down and get focused and get centered. So, yeah, I totally agree with you. And then on the break, what people didn't hear was Paula was talking about, talking about the South. And so, and I said to her that all these masters, Maharishi Mahesh and Amaji and all these people that, gurus that people follow, they're all tantric. So, Paula, why don't we come back to you on that? Why don't you talk a little bit about
all of the ones, the famous ones that you hear about, that was what the young master told me. He said that all of the big gurus never taught what it was that got them to their stature. And that's why he was wanting me to give India a second try. You know, and he said what they saw was the Divine Mother. They actually had darshan with the Divine Mother, and so did Buddha and Jesus and, you know, Muhammad.
And the Dalai Lama, of course, all of them.
Well, I don't know about the Dalai Lama. I'm not a big Lama,
okay.
the whole idea of Tantra, even with those masters who you think aren't at all interested in that, like, say, Advaita, you know, the non-dualists, say Ramana Maharshi, somebody told me he had a Sri Yantra in his ashram, and that's, you know, generally it's a complex variation of the Star of David.
It's the combination, the bottom triangle being the feminine aspect, a triangle where the point is facing downwards. It can symbolize Kali or it can symbolize feminine. And then the triangle that's pointing upwards symbolizes the male aspect. And that triangle symbol, that whole pyramid thing, is such a powerful, powerful sacred geometry.
Yeah, so they take these yantras and they bury them, or they have them somewhere in their ashram. They don't necessarily display them, but even if they're hidden, sometimes they say the hidden ones are even more powerful. And so I began to notice that there were people in the Theosophical Society that, you know, if you could sort of peek beneath their blouse or whatever, they were wearing a swastika. But then it sort of did something to me. I thought, you know, why don't people just reclaim the swastika? Why, because of some guy like Adolf Hitler, or maybe they've just sort of written off all of Western civilization as perfectly hopeless, and therefore they're just going to hide this. You know, why not just come out? And I started to look around Gramercy Park, and I found in the tile work itself, pre-World War II Nazi stuff, you could see swastikas.
Mm.
So... what's hidden and what's not hidden, what should be hidden, what should not be hidden. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the little small mantras, was told to me by a Brahmin couple that was teaching me yoga who didn't like my interest in Tantra. They said, look it, Tantra just means something simple for the common person who can't memorize long verses. They couldn't memorize the long shlokas, or they don't live in a well-organized society that can hire the priests on a regular basis to chant these shlokas, which are all about being in balance with nature. like Molly said, you know, it's a science of manifestation. And so the times degenerate and they're corrupt and it's so horrible, and pretty soon average regular people need access to this peace of mind, and their priestly caste has betrayed them. You know, they're all running off to join Microsoft. And so they get... That's what they're doing. The Brahmins,
yes,
south of India, they don't want to be priests. They want to work for Bill Gates, and they're very eager employees, which is kind of the downside of India. You don't see that hardy individualist that will strike out. And sometimes the ones that do strike out become kind of outcasts from society. They live on the fringes, and that might be the Aghori class.
Who I want to meet. Those are the people I want to meet, the Aghoris.
It's difficult to meet one of those people because chances are you're going to be so disgusted when you see them that you think, oh, they stink and they smell. But truly, these are the people who do cultivate the great love of the divine very rapidly because, like I said, they don't have access. Like, if you have access to a real first-class priest and beautiful ceremonies and the chanting, it just sends you to another dimension. It is so beautiful. It makes your body so refined. You're just that. You're refined. But if you're in the midst of poverty and there's so much corruption going on and the priests are bought off or they're going off to work in Seattle for Microsoft, then what's a sincere soul to do? And so nature will always have the solution close at hand. In that case, if the heart is yearning and pure and open, it will attract to it what it needs. And in that case, it needs a very simple procedure, some simple mantras.
Yes.
And if you're, you know, lucky enough to get the attention of a real master, then he can watch over and make sure that you make the connection all the way. And I was just thinking lately, the definition of perversion is that the natural energies of desire aren't hitting the fulfillment. You're not making the connection with the divine. And that's the male and female is a very, very precious and sacred opportunity to have two polarities come together. But look at what happens when there's no knowledge. It sinks into fantasies and Viagra and misunderstandings.
And war. I mean, there's war between the genders, and then it gets reflected in war in the world.
Right.
I mean, that's
right.
Just, it's just amazing. Well, so, you know, it's interesting that you said, going back just a little while, you said something about what is seen and what is not seen. Oh, you know, we have to stop soon. Oh, I can't stand being on the show with you and having to stop.
Well, come back
in
the yantras.
Well, I did want to say that Osho has a whole book about what is seen and what is not seen, things that are symbols that look to the obvious, but those were just a decoy for other hidden things that were only supposed to be divulged when the student is ready. So it comes back to this, the beginning of the show where you said this teacher told you, you know, you had to sit and say these mantras and get yourself ready in a place of compassion before you were going to learn anything else about tantra.
Lori, let me tell you, he didn't tell me that. He knew the nature of my ego. If he told me that, I would have been like, you know, a bat out of hell. It was huge skill on his part before that finally happened.
Well, we have to end on that note. So I'm actually going to make this into a little lesson for people and say that sometimes what appears as the obvious and makes us want to run and makes us want to quit and makes us want to give up is our ego not wanting to do something that knows, the ego knows that it's in for some kind of killing itself off by whatever the practice is or by whatever the recommendation is. And the most times when we want to run, when we know we're doing something good for ourselves, perhaps there's something hidden and unseen, that which will be such a benefit to not only ourselves but to all of humanity if we just stick it out and keep our butt in the chair. So I, you know, I'm just going to make that as a lesson because I think it goes for me too, and I imagine it goes for most of our listeners who are on some kind of a higher journey or wanting to be on some kind of a higher journey. So anyway, I want to thank you, Paula. I want to thank you so much for coming back on my show. I feel like our conversations are so minuscule and we have so much more to go. Like, there's so many more things to talk to you about. So
yeah,
I'm going to invite you back to the show.
Definitely be a guest on my show. I really look forward to it, Laurie.
That's wonderful. And we will, and Molly, too, I thank you. It was a surprise visit you paid. And I hear that you want to plan some kind of a trip to the south of India, and count me in. And we'll see what we can create.
There's some huge temples in the south of India that are on the scale of Egyptian ones, and that's what I want to explore: Egyptian, Christian, Jewish. You know, see if we can see some commonalities in the architecture.
I'd love to go, and I also would like to go up to the mountains as well. So, we'll talk more about it. I want to thank you both for being here, being my guests, and I'm going to sign off for a Tantra Cafe. This is Laurie Handlers. I hope you'll be with us next week. My guest will be Rusty Stewart, who's a psychologist and a shaman in the Philadelphia area. And I welcome you back with open arms anytime to Tantra Cafe. Thank you, and namaste.
Namaste.